I'm Freddie, host of Unforgotten, a podcast series which dives into the 2009 unsolved murder of Matt Stewart. The following is a special question and answer episode, featuring a conversation recorded earlier this week between myself and Steve, moderator of the Unforgotten Forum, located at unforgotten.freeforums.net. The forum is not directly affiliated with the podcast, but we share a similar goal in generating attention to and conversation about this still unresolved case. If you have any suggestions about topics or questions to be included in future special episodes, you can submit them on the forum. Sign up at unforgotten.freeforums.net. And now, here's the episode.
Hello, my name is Steve, and I'm the moderator of the Unforgotten Forums located at unforgotten.freeforums.net.
How are you doing?
Good, good. How are you, Freddie?
I'm doing all right.
We've had a lot of activity over at the forums. It's been good to see people starting to talk about the case again and come up with new ideas.
It warms my heart to see a community of people that are not ready to let this go. I've been posting on the forum and using the forum, and would encourage every listener, if you're not going on and viewing, to do that. And then if you have something to say, definitely sign up. It can be completely anonymous.
It's at unforgotten.freeforums.net. We've got lots of members there who are posting regularly now, and 100 or more guests that visit a day and don't post. It's a place to get additional information about the case and maybe to see some aspects of theories that have been talked about online that Freddie hasn't really touched on in the podcast. There's more there than you'll get from just the podcast. The two working together seem to really flesh out aspects of the case that you might otherwise not be aware of. All right, well, I was hoping we could take some time to go over the details of what was reported in the media as having happened the night of Matt's death. It seems there's been a reasonably consistent narrative that showed up in most places that have covered the story, and I think there's a value in discussing it more in more detail than the news articles did. I'm hoping that with your extensive research and reading on the case, that maybe you can shed some light on some aspects that I've been wondering about, and that maybe together we could come up with a few items that listeners can help us track down. So here's my understanding of that evening, at least if we assume that the details we've seen in the media are accurate. So it was very early morning on June 9th, maybe 30 minutes after midnight. It's warm, but not excessively hot outside. Historical data shows it was a little over 70 degrees and the moon was nearly full. There is very little wind. It was partly cloudy, so it isn't one of those pitch black nights. So once your eyes had adjusted, you could probably make your way around without a flashlight if there were any light sources nearby. The Stewart house was in a neighborhood named Gabriel Estates. Is that right?
Yes.
And did that neighborhood have several entrances or only one?
The entrance to the neighborhood from the road that it's off of is Shinville Road, which is right at the intersection between where Shinville shoots off from essentially what is the combination now of 115 and 21. And Gabriel Drive is kind of the main road there, and there's a kind of a triangle. It goes Shepherd's Hill Drive, shoots off. If you're coming to the 158 Shepherd's Hill Drive where this occurred, you could take Shepherd's Hill Drive from Gabriel Drive, or you could take Northland Avenue. But from Shinville Road, to really get into the Gabriel Estates neighborhood, there is only one entrance, and that's through, you have to come down Gabriel Drive. Once you're in that neighborhood, there's two ways to get to the Stewart's house. You can go through down Northland Avenue, or you can go down Shepherd's Hill Drive. There's only one entrance, and one exit for that matter.
And was the Stewart house located near to any of these entrances? I'd imagine that someone targeting a random house would be considering how easily they'd be able to get out of the area.
It's not a huge development, but in the context of the neighborhood, it is not near an entrance. It's not like a corner house or anything right off one of the entrance or exit roads. It's kind of in the middle of the neighborhood.
It's not something that you would immediately think, oh, that's a good target to do a robbery. It's not a place that you look at and say that would be an easy place to escape from.
I am not a robber, but in my amateur opinion, I mean, I think most of us know, I think, probably what would go through someone's head if they were trying to go undetected. And I don't think that it would be the typical place that would be hit for that, no, for multiple multiple reasons.
So my understanding of the layout is that there were houses on either side of them, and then behind them there was a berm of some sort which separated them from the homes that were located on the main road behind them. Is that right?
Yes. They're one kind of proximity that would make them not in the middle of the neighborhood is they are on the west side of the neighborhood, and the Stewart's backyard backs up to houses that were off of 115, Highway 115. And they're in a spot kind of parallel to where Highway 21 and 115 connect. It's not in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. There was also a Shell gas station not too far away?
Yes. Yep, still is. Still there. The Shell is kind of right in between that intersection there.
So if you were in their backyard and you crossed over that berm, I guess from looking at Google Maps, there would be a rather large lot between them and the road, and that Shell station's over there in that area. Sounds like it would be a pretty good way to go in and out. Is there more to it than that, or would it be that easy?
So one thing that really struck me a few months ago, I went back to the neighborhood for the first time. So it was interesting kind of seeing the whole layout. And if you go on Google Maps, probably what's not really clear is the large hill. And what I noticed is the shrubbery. It's not like a just grass going up the hill. There's pine needles and bushes, and it did not look like a backyard where you could just quickly run from the back door or the porch of the Stewart's house to 115. It would be difficult for anyone to go up that, and especially considering that there was extensive investigation of the scene, if someone did take that route, if that shrubbery was all still there at the time, which neighbors told me that it was, it would be very difficult to do that undetected. And there would be some real clear signs of someone trying to struggle to get up that big hill. So I'm not saying they didn't do it, but I would assume that if they had, then law enforcement would have figured that out fairly quickly.
What about cameras? Were there cameras at the Stewart house or the neighbors or in that area in general that were aware of?
The neighbors that I've talked to did not have cameras. The closest camera that we know of was at the Shell gas station. You know, the neighbor that I talked to that was next door to the Stewarts said that law enforcement told her, unfortunately, there was nothing that could be found on those security tapes.
So with the description that we have, the layout, we've already identified most of the options for the killer to approach the house. There were no reports indicating any vehicle seen in or near the driveway of their house, so we have to assume that even if the attacker did have a vehicle, they approached the house on foot for at least some distance. Is that consistent with your understanding?
She doesn't report seeing any kind of vehicle out of the ordinary parked outside that could be identified, and neither do any of the neighbors that I spoke with, and there's certainly no record that's available to the public on that.
At this point, I think we'd have to limit the possibilities to someone either living within walking distance or within walking distance to some other transportation. And it seems like it would be challenging to get over that berm, especially without leaving a trace. But let's assume it's possible for now, at least for getting to the house. So the killer had to have either come to the house by either brazenly walking down the street, getting dropped off in front of the house, slinking behind the neighboring houses, or coming over that berm, right? There's really no other way. They obviously did reach the house. And maybe they tried other homes first, maybe they didn't, if this really were a random home invasion. I suppose they could have tried other places first and gotten all the way down the street to this house. To me, that would seem unlikely, but it's certainly possible.
I can tell you in that regard, the two houses next to them on both sides had dogs. Their owners would not have stayed sleeping had there been someone, you know, trying to break into their home, in their opinion, just from their testimony. So, you know, I find it hard to believe that they had tried either of those houses before they tried the Stewart's house. But it could be that it wasn't the first house that they tried.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they were going house to house, door to door.
Well, it seems just as unlikely they'd be randomly skipping houses either. So that's just one more nail in the coffin of the idea of a random home invasion. We're at the point now where we're not sure how he got there, but the killer's literally in the yard, ready to start this horrible tragedy into motion. And according to all reports in the media and elsewhere, inside the house we have Matt and Angel sleeping with their youngest child in bed with them. And their 3-year-old is in a separate bedroom, and their oldest child isn't home, but she's at a sleepover several houses down the street.
Yes.
Right? So the killer, perhaps nothing more than a burglar at this point, has four ways to enter this house from what I've seen. He can try the front door, the sliding glass back door, come in through the garage, or somehow get in a window. I've looked at pictures of the house online from when it was for sale, so I have a reasonably good feel for the layout of the house. Do you have an actual floor plan for it?
I don't have an actual floor plan, no.
That would be a great thing that a listener could contribute if they live in the neighborhood or know someone who lives in the neighborhood who has that same floor plan. To know the exact layout with confidence would really help in the future if we're going to try to analyze what was happening in the house.
If you've got it, send it my way. Email's unforgottenpod@gmail.com.
And have you heard any reports on how access was gained to the house? I know there weren't supposed to be any signs of forced entry.
Both neighbors to either side of the Stewarts have both indicated to me that there was no sign of forced entry and that a door was open.
So I did just a little bit of research online today, just a quick Google search to see if sliding glass doors are secure or one of the more easier types of doors to get into. It seems like there are ways to open those kinds of doors if you don't use a bar to actually hold it captive in the closed position. So it is possible that somebody could have gotten in through the back sliding glass door without it looking like forced entry if they didn't have a bar of that sort there. But obviously there's no way to know. But let's assume that a door was unlocked. After all, since the oldest child wasn't home, it's quite possible that the parents would have left the door open to allow that child to get back in easily if something came up and she wanted to come back home.
That's a good point.
Now the killer tries the door and it opens. Is there a dog they'd have to worry about or anything inside?
To my knowledge, there was no dog at the Stewart's house.
Okay. And all the people in the house are upstairs at this point, and the intruder's downstairs.
Yes.
Do we know if anything was disturbed downstairs? Have you heard any reports or anything one way or the other?
What I have been told by multiple sources is that nothing in the house was disturbed, other than in the master bedroom and the master bathroom.
Which is where the attack happened.
Yes.
The killer decides to move upstairs. That seems to show both recklessness and intent to me, don't you think? I mean, they could leave right now and no one would ever be alerted, but they choose instead to creep up the stairs. So looking at the layout of the house, the little bit I can figure out, just stairs are located in front of the house right by the front door. From what I can tell, it's the only way up. If they came in the front door, they would have been right there, but from the back, they'd have to make their way through the house to the front to get there. The killer would have to quietly climb up, and at the top of the stairs is that master bedroom entrance. When the killer enters the bedroom, an angel wakes up, seeing a tall intruder, or at least that's what we've heard from the reports, right?
Yes.
So their youngest child, I assume, is laying between her and Matt. That's just the only way, in my mind, it makes sense. If you have a child in the bed with you, you don't put it to either side. The child ends up between the two parents. Shots ring out, and Matt is up and trying to stop the attacker. Angel gets shot in the wrist, just missing the child, and Matt yells for her to get out as the attacker closes in to struggle with Matt. And somehow a knife enters the picture, and Matt ends up in the bathroom. There's at least six shots fired in total, and the autopsy would suggest not all at the same time, but spread out through the fight. But by this time, Angel's out of the room with her youngest, and her three-year-old is still asleep in her room across the hall. And that child won't wake up throughout the attack. Is that right?
That is my understanding from what's been relayed to me.
We'll just continue to take everything at face value. I mean, this is what was all reported in the media. At this point, Angel flees down the stairs, apparently leaving her other child in her panic. And we have to assume she exits the house out the nearest available door, which would be the front door.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, the first thing people go to here is that she left one of her kids behind. And I mean, that's what's going to be on people's minds.
Yeah, I think that the counter-argument is, guess we can all assume the actions that we would take if put in that scenario, but we might not actually act the way that we think that we would act. What I think has been expressed to me, or I know it's been expressed to me, is that she didn't feel like she could get that child out of the house without jeopardizing all of their lives.
And honestly, I'm on board with that at the moment. The more I've thought about that, I think an injured woman with a child in her arms fleeing from a attacker who just literally shot her would not necessarily risk the life of the child in her arms and her own life in order to go to a different part of the house to get a child that could get overlooked completely. So given the panic, pain, disorienting situation, I don't think it's as far-fetched as a lot of people do, but obviously everyone has their own opinion on that. So we're operating under the assumption here that Angel is in full self-preservation mode now, and she's just trying to escape with the child in her arms. Mm-hmm. So she gets outside and heads to the house across the street, and she runs down the driveway. She must have left the front door open behind her in her flight, and I'm sure that anyone in this situation would be very aware if someone were right behind them. I mean, I can't imagine she took her eyes off that front door for more than a millisecond this whole time, just to be sure no one was chasing her down. I mean, obviously we can't know that, but I don't think anybody putting themselves in that situation wouldn't consider that to be part of the self-preservation of the moment to make sure there's not somebody literally right behind you.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, speaking with Matt's oldest daughter, she expressed to me that part of the story that her mom has told her is that as she was running from the house, she heard the final shot ring out, supposedly the one that killed Matt. So that would indicate to me, you know, if she was still under the assumption that it was one attacker, she wouldn't necessarily be thinking, and during that run, that she had someone on her tail necessarily.
Sure, right. Although, if you're running as fast as you can, you're not closing doors behind you. So
no, I wouldn't necessarily expect the door to be closed.
If what you're saying is true, that gives the indication that at least once the front door was open, you could hear the shots from at least as far away as the driveway.
Yeah.
So she gets to the neighbor and bangs on the door. Someone answers and she's inside now. So obviously something terrible is going on and there's clearly a threat nearby. So I think we can also assume that from this point on, either Angel or someone in the neighbor's house has their eye on that open door across the street the whole time.
Yes.
So the time's now 12:45 and 32 seconds, and 911 answers the call from Angela Stewart. Do we have a transcript or audio of that call?
No, we don't. One of the first things that I wanted to do when I started investigating this was get my hands on the transcript or the tape of the call. So I kind of researched what it would take to get that or to try to find if it still exists, and I found that the state of North Carolina does allow for the public to access those calls, but those recordings are only saved by those public agencies for 2 years. So there's no way to request that tape now. It would be my assumption that it was requested at least by the investigation, and I would imagine the investigation has that tape, but I haven't been able to get a hold of it. That would be another challenge to the audience. If you can find a tape and send it to the podcast, you get a gold star.
So, I mean, that is a possibility, right? It could still exist somewhere. Perhaps these tapes were not destroyed. It's just a question of finding the right person.
Well, anyone could have requested that. I would be curious and was curious and have requested for every known media agency in the Charlotte area. I've asked if they have that tape. For the most part, I've gotten no response. The Mooresville Tribune and the Statesville Record and Landmark, they did not request those tapes in that allotted amount of time. It would be wonderful to get that. What we do have is the 911 call log, which basically pinpoints when exact actions were taken as far as when the call went through, when the first officers arrived at the scene, when the officers called for the SWAT team. You know, all of the major events are recorded in that and given a time.
And that document's available on the forum as well. So police are now on their way, and it will only be 3 minutes and 51 seconds before they are there at the scene. So let's think about this because I think it's very important. If we give Angel 30 seconds to flee the bedroom, get downstairs, cross the street, get the neighbor's attention, and then call 911, we're talking about a total of 4 minutes and 20 seconds from the first shot until the police are there at the scene. That's amazing reaction time on the part of the police, don't you think?
Yeah, and I think from folks that I've spoken with involved in law enforcement, you know, someone was down the street and got the, you know, that someone was on patrol, basically got the call and said, oh, you know, I'm 2 minutes away.
That could be, and I don't disagree with the possibility that you just said. But if I read the report right, and we'll break this down maybe at a later date, it wasn't but just one officer that showed up. There were two officers there within a couple of seconds of that 4 minute mark.
It said two officers.
I think they had. I don't have it in front of me, and I should have. I'm not prepared, obviously, but I think there was another squad car within 15 or 20 seconds of that first one.
Wow.
So they were right on the, they were right there. One of the reasons I wanted to look over the document even more, because it's got so much like that in there.
Well, it does beg the question, how did someone that did all this damage to Matt, which is clearly seen in the ME report, how were they able to do all of that and then disappear completely?
Right. And that's what I'm getting to with this here. So let's go back to the bedroom now. And the killer's gotten into a vicious struggle with Matt. There's multiple types of bullets used, strongly suggesting more than one gun. There's many knife wounds. The bathroom has been reported as being covered in blood, and Matt had defensive wounds indicating that he put up a hell of a fight. But in the end, the killer succeeds in ending Matt's life. This was no quiet execution. This was an epic struggle. Do we know if neighbors became aware of the sounds of the shots fired?
There's no one that heard anything that I could find at all. That includes neighbors that were right next door who basically say, in their opinion, you know, I can imagine can be deceptive given, you know, if the AC is on, if they're in a deep sleep. But to me, it is worth noting that it is a neighborhood where the houses are relatively close together. So it's notable that no one heard anything.
In any event, the murderer prevails, and he knows that someone has escaped. So he must realize instantly that the police are on the way, and now he has to flee, right? He has no time to clean up the scene or to clean up himself unless it's something absolutely essential in his mind. So he's immediately out of the room, down the stairs, and there in front of him is the open front door. He doesn't take it, presumably, since we have no reports of Angel or the neighbor saying that they've seen a fleeing man. We have to assume that if they had, it would have been the first thing they mentioned when the police arrived, and an instant manhunt would have ensued. And he certainly didn't go out the garage for the same reason, and why waste time with the window? So he has to go out the back sliding door. Nothing else makes sense. And leaving it open behind him because the body upstairs makes it pointless to try and hide the fact that he was there, at this point, getting away would have to be his primary goal. Do you see anything that would contradict that logic?
No, and I would add, too, that you would assume if they had saw the perpetrator fleeing out the front door, getting to the three-year-old would be something that would happen immediately and that there wouldn't be that holdup with the 100 minutes before entering the house. But I think that's part of what contributes to that, to, I think, safely assuming that the perpetrator did not enter out the front door.
Sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So with this kind of rushing to get out, we also have to assume that he left a blood trail through the house and out the back door. It seems near impossible that someone could have caused so much damage to Matt and not be covered in blood. Do we know if this is the case? I mean, have you heard anything about blood in other parts of the house?
I haven't, no.
So there's obviously so much information in the police files that we are not going to have access to that would shed big light onto the crime scene. There would have to have been some kind of trail. They must have seen this. They must know where the person went and how. I just can't imagine there not being some kind of trace evidence of how this person fled.
I think you're right. I think that given what we've been told, you would assume that there would be a trail. But what's almost become the norm in this case is kind of breaking assumptions.
So now the killer's in the backyard, and the way I see it, there's only three options. You head over the berm and through all those bushes, which we would assume would show some sign of his passage and possibly blood droplets, or head off behind the houses on either side of the Stewart's home, and again, quite possibly leaving some blood traces. Have you seen or heard of anything suggesting any of this?
No, I mean, I know that their yard was searched extensively. You know, I remember asking the neighbor who was in the fourth episode, she did remember the dogs being there and the dogs being in the yard and searching. basically what she was told from police, that they never really concluded where the intruder had, and this is her recollection, 9 years had passed. No, you take that with a grain of salt. What she did seem sure of, and I think was in the interview, she seemed pretty certain that the person entered the back door.
Yeah, I think that's the only thing that makes sense in this situation. But like you said, even the things that you would expect to make sense in this case don't necessarily make sense. So in a previous podcast, you mentioned a neighbor who heard things in their backyard.
Yes.
Where was that neighbor's house in proximity to their house?
Yeah, like I said in the episode, when I looked on the map as to where this person's house was, it's not in a proximity to the house where you would expect a perpetrator, if someone was trying to leave unnoticed, they wouldn't have either come from that house or gone through it while exiting. It was down the street. Basically, there was two cul-de-sacs, one kind of right next door to where the sewers are, and this was down the street, actually off of Gabriel Drive. There's a cul-de-sac kind of at the other end of Shepherd's Hill.
You said that the time they heard their dogs going crazy was about 12:15, which would mean it was the person entering the neighborhood rather than fleeing it, wouldn't it?
If the timeline is to be believed, that would be the case.
I didn't even think of it from that standpoint, that maybe the timeline might not match. Somehow, even though the police were apparently flooding into the area only minutes later, with as many as four cars arriving onto the scene, according to the 911 report, this murderer manages to get to a place of safety without anyone seeing his blood-covered clothes and without alerting anyone to the point where we see a description of this guy. That's no small accomplishment for someone in this situation. So what are your thoughts? I don't have a place to go from here, but it's worth pointing out, it doesn't seem likely somebody that covered in blood can just disappear without having a vehicle or something as a getaway, right?
It would not seem likely, no.
I don't know. This is where it all falls apart, right? How does that guy get away? That's the real question. If everything else, even if you can get through all of the other aspects of this, you still have that 4 minute block where this guy has to go from upstairs in their house to someplace safe enough that he's not even seen. And there has to be a theory to account for that for this case to have some kind of closure.
Unless if the person was in a car when they entered the neighborhood and they had a getaway car, if police are coming to the scene, unless the assailant was somehow able to get out of the house and get out of the entire neighborhood before law enforcement got into the neighborhood, they would have had to have passed each other.
There's also no reports of the neighbor or Angel seeing any cars going by.
No.
So that backs up this idea that going across that berm or at some point exiting the neighborhood by crossing over to another street is the only alternative.
Yes. Sightings of a vehicle, you would assume that too would be reported in the description. When police were trying to get the word out about the sketch, they would have likely included that information.
Right. All right. Well, this moves it on to the listeners and the members of the forum, I think. So they come back to us and tell us what we got wrong and what questions we didn't ask but should have about this night. There's lots of possible theories for what happened, but just based on the media accounts, I think we had a reasonable breakdown of some of the challenges the scenario has inherently built into it. It seems like a lot of things had to go together in a very specific way for any of this to have happened the way it was reported to have happened. If you want to talk about this, you can reach me and Freddie and other members of the forum at unforgotten.freeforums.net.
Unforgotten is a Bold Era production, written and recorded by myself, Freddie Wilson, in the always sunny Daytona Beach, Florida. As always, this series is dedicated to the life of Matt Stewart. May his memory remain unforgotten.